Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 198 for comics originally released on May 25th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is a Vertigo title. It's Strange Adventures Number 1. This is a 80-page anthology with, seven or eight different, actually about nine or ten stories.
A whole lot of stories.
Whole bunch of stuff.
Seven, eight, nine stories.
Now, I am a sci-fi fan, but I'm not a huge anthology fan, so that kind of put this in a, you know, questionable spot. And I read some Vertigo titles, but I don't really consider myself a Vertigo target audience member. They tend to go a little bit more into kind of the supernatural and the creepy and stuff at times.
I was thinking of you and how you were how you would ultimately react when I read the story Refuse.
Yeah. Why don't we go kind of story by story on this? Okay. I've got a couple of notes on each, and I'm going to say from the get-go, though, there is a target audience that is going to just love this. I don't consider myself a member of that.
Yeah, I can see that this book would go from 5 out of 5 best thing ever created on the face of the earth down to, you know, like some people saying it's a 1 out of 5, you know, I totally didn't get it. And then like somewhere in the middle, you know, are people who can like recognize the craft of some of the stories and realize that, you know, they're not all necessarily for them. You know,
well, it's... The other thing that I think would color ratings on this book is the fact it's an anthology. There are nine stories. Now, I think they were close enough in tone and style and nature that I don't think somebody's going to say, oh, wow, I love this one and hate all the others, or have wildly different ratings between them. I mean, there'll be variations, of course. But I would be a little surprised if there's some people who thought like half of them were ones and half of them were fives or something.
Right.
But there is going to be what percentage of this justified the cover cost, which is a fairly steep $7.99. Now, granted, we're getting about 80 pages a story or so. I didn't actually count them, but I mean that's a fair, you know, number of story pages for that price. But again, do you want to pay $7.99 if you only like two or three of the stories?
Right, and it's right at that same point as like Dark Horse Presents, right?
Yeah. All right,
I thought that Dark Horse Presents, on the other hand, they put a lot, well, I don't want to say strumming, they put a lot more well-known talent into Dark Horse Presents.
That's fair. There are about half these people that I recognize the names. I mean, we've got Jeff Lemire, Dennis Cohen, Peter Milligan, Paul Cornell, Azarello.
Well-known is probably not the best word. I mean, more like, you know, when you're looking at, like, Frank Miller and Neil Adams and, Paul Chad, a lot more, like,
rated.
Legendary status type of people versus kind of very solid comic people, but not
A-list talent.
Legendy kind of people, you know. And it's like I would say, so let's just start. I mean, like, so you got the first story is called Case 21. Writer is Selwyn Hines, who I am not familiar with, and the art's by Dennis Cowan, who I am. I thought it was a fine story. It is, you know, left a lot of reading between the lines necessary to get the kind of Twilight Zone twist ending that they had there, but it was an okay story.
You know, I thought it was a good urban story in kind of a sci-fi setting. I mean, I liked it well enough. You know, for me, this is probably one of the ones that clicked with me the best. But I didn't like it so much that if it was going to be like an ongoing or even a miniseries that I'd necessarily follow it into that. It was a good short story, and that's all I think it set out to be. But it wasn't something that I thought was like a good pilot for, you know, moving forward. So for me, this was kind of, you know, average quality and was good. I thought the ending was pretty clear to, you know, what the twist was and not have to read between the lines at all.
Well, I wasn't reading between the lines on the twist ending. I was reading between the lines on, you know, the setup of the world and what all was going on with the above world and below world and all this kind of business. I mean, they kind of like...
I think that's the nature of the format, though.
Yeah.
When you've only got, you know, what, 8 or 10 pages or something, we'll say 8, you're going to have to toss a lot of things in there where one line of caption or whatever really, you know, implies a whole lot of the backstory and status quo of the world. So I was fine with that, but I see what you're saying now. So
yeah, and, you know, it's just like some of the stories, they just read as those, you know, you got a couple of pages and you're driving to the reveal at the end. I mean, that's what the story's about, right?
It's and it comes down to, is that reveal worthy of what they, you know, the journey or whatever? And sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. I think for Case 21... I felt there was enough story on the way to that end that I was pleased with that. But there were a few others where, yeah, it's like that's where they went. So, and this next one, The White Room, you know, I didn't like the art style, but that's just me. The story had some interesting ideas, but again, it was one of those you gotta kind of read into it a little. And it wasn't a bad story, but I didn't feel like it was a lot of story either. This one I was a little unimpressed with. How about you?
Similar. I mean, I'm not a big Juan Bobbio fan. He did that Howard the Duck miniseries over at Marvel. That's the one thing that I remember him from. I think his art style is something that some people are going to like. And it's okay. I like him doing this kind of stuff a lot better than doing established characters who would tend to look nothing at all like the established characters are supposed to look like. I would probably read something like this illustrated by him, whereas if he's on a core Marvel or DC character, I probably wouldn't care for that. Not really familiar with Talia Hirschshoe, who is the writer. And again, kind of sketchy setup. You got kind of like two twists in one, I guess. You don't really know what was going wrong with the White Room, or maybe it's the girl, something's going on, but then you get like the double twist of, you know, at the end. It was amusing, but, you know, whatever. So next we've got Partners, which, you know, again, we've got Peter Milligan, who's an accomplished writer. Sylvain Savoia, not really that familiar with, more of a typical comics style going on here. It was an okay story. I don't know. I mean, the story itself, it's really hard to talk about an 8-page story without giving any kind of a spoiler, you know. It's just, we start sounding redundant, I think.
What it came down to for me with this one is it had an interesting concept, but it took too long to put it out there. This is something where I can see where that concept could go in a couple of very interesting directions. Here, however, since we don't get that until just about the end, you know, it's one of those where you read the story and have to then go back and rethink about that story in light of the reveal at the end. And sometimes it's very effective, whatever.
Kind of like sixth sensing it.
Yeah. You know, and it's one of those where it does start to feel almost a little formulaic, where so far, you know, all three of these, it's like you go up and then, oh, here's the twist or whatever. And it's like, that's fine, but a good sci-fi story can introduce a cool concept at the beginning and just kind of run with it for a little bit. And this is one of those where they could have even put the concept up front and it worked. You know, all in all, the story was kind of okay, but it bothered me that the most interesting point of it was revealed there, really, you know, on that last page. Whereas, you know, this next story, All the Pretty Ponies, I mean, right on that second and third page, bam, here's the idea that this thing has.
And actually, this is the well, I'm not remembering, we'll see as we get to the other ones, but this is the one concept that I thought could actually carry a series best.
Yeah.
You know, this one, they kind of like twisted a little bit to have the, again, the little twist ending. This one left me most at the end of it saying, boy, I'd like to read more set in this world. I also liked the art style in this by Inaki Miranda, or Miranda, the best. Very nice art style.
Yeah, this was some good stuff. You know, I liked the art in this. It had a very interesting story with some really cool ideas that it used very well. And this was the one that I could really see going to a miniseries, a full series, or, you know, a movie or whatever. This had some fairly cinematic ideas, a few of which are reminiscent to some existing stuff already out there. But it, again, it had some really cool ideas. It used some captions pretty well to give them a little bit of context and put some spin on them. And the twist at the end served to add another layer, but I felt the layer that the story had just kind of there at the surface was so strong that I was really pleased with this one. To me, this was one of the highlights of the book. You know, if this went to series, yeah, I'd go with it.
Yeah, that was a really good story. Now, the next one, Ultra the Multi-Alien. I mean, Ultra the Multi-Alien was a character, I don't know how many other places he appeared, if at all. He was in a series of, I don't know, 7 to 10 issues of Mystery into Space around issue 100 of that title. Coincidentally, I just picked up like the last 4 of those I was missing when I was out at the Phoenix Con. So I actually am familiar with who Ultra the Multi-Alien is and have read the original stories. So this one, I'm not sure how this would work for people who are not sure who Ultra the Multi-Alien is. He, you know, Lemire is taking this one, and of course this is someone, you know, story and art by Jeff Lemire. People will be familiar with him from Sweet Tooth, at least from the art style. He's also writing Superboy. He wrote Adam. Well known. This one was a little different than the other ones in that he's taking an existing one of these wacky space characters from DC's past and putting more of a Vertigo twist onto it. And you've got a little bit of a kind of Twilight Zone-y kind of ending to it, you know, with Ultra's personality being subsumed by these 4 aliens that he's a part of. I thought he did a relatively effective job in introducing the character. I don't think this is a strong enough character particularly to carry any kind of a story beyond this, though.
I thought this was kind of the most standard backup feature-ish kind of a story out of the lot. I mean, this could have been a whatever happened to the Ultra Multi-Alien thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those backup features they did back in the 80s. I mean, this had a nice recap of his origin. A nice cameo, actually, some of the other space heroes, kind of putting him into that context, more in the DC Universe than the Vertigo stuff. It was really kind of a sad story. And it was one of those of just kind of, okay, here's who he is, here's who he was, here's a little of his you know, status quo, state of being, you know, whatever. Very much a good introduction to the character, but not one of those where I felt it really left the character with, and now he's going to have wonderful adventures. It's now kind of, wow, that would really suck to be him.
Yeah, I mean, it was very well done, but, you know, it comes out of it as like, wow, that was really depressing, you know, as I read that.
Yeah. But again, yeah. This is the kind of thing where if DC, with their, you know, new 52 title lineup or whatever, were to have something where this kind of a thing could have fit in, that would allow them to kind of take all the other characters that are sitting in limbo, you know, in the virtual storage closet of the DC library, dust them off, put them out there, and just say, yeah, they still exist. And I mean, this is enough that if people love this character, want to see more, or whatever, that they can now write in. It prompts them to write in and say, wow, this is really good. Can we see more of this? Can we see more of Jeff Lemire? Or whatever. So it's, this one was interesting. It was the most DC Universe-ish of all of these stories, by far. and then we hit refuse.
Even for someone who doesn't get grossed out and I read like zombie books and I read horror books, heck, I read Crossed. This was kind of a disgusting story. It's like, you know, I don't even know what to say about this story. This story seems to exist just to be disgusting to me. And again, this is from someone who reads Crossed, which also to some extent exists to be shocking and revolting in many ways. You know, there's a storyline going along with it, but when you have only 8 pages, you know, this is all about shock value and stuff, it seems to me.
Yeah, this was one where it was a kind of a creepy, disgusting story. It was well told. I just didn't care for the story being told. It, you know, kind of starts off with what looks like a set or a scene or something you might find in the show Hoarders going wrong, you know, kind of a thing. And then from there, it just goes in this really weird direction. And part of it is, not only was it disgusting, it's there was so little story. It really seemed to take place, you know, I guess over time, because she's in different outfits or whatever, but the pacing of the story, other than certain things needing some time to happen, it felt like it happened in the span of an afternoon.
Yeah, but there's, you know, what I got out of this is there wasn't much of a setup, although I guess, you know, when she's cleaning up there on, like, the second page, you get kind of like something happened. I would have liked to have seen that object down in the lower right-hand corner a little clearer.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of give some kind of, or even having her find that, which would actually have some kind of a twist that sets up as to why the series of events happens. You know, it's just, you didn't get any of that in
the
story.
It's one of those where things happen with no motivation to a certain degree. You're right, yeah.
It could have been done in such a way, I think, making a couple of minor tweaks that would have taken the story a couple of notches better for me.
Yeah, for me, I was, again, crafted in terms of the execution was well done, but not one I cared for at all, unsurprisingly.
Now, this next one seemed to span the most amount of time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like years and years, apparently. I didn't really know what to think of this one. This one was kind of weird.
This was another kind of creepy story, another kind of almost Twilight Zone-ish sort of a thing. I thought it was overall well told. It had a lot of story in here, not the story I particularly cared for, again, just my tastes, but so much of it was told in flashback, and that pretty much worked for this. It had a framing sequence of two guys at a bar, and one kind of telling him his story, and it, you know, plays out from there. So it was very clear all of this was past tense. But again, we get pretty much a character's entire life story here. It was, I think, probably one of the best uses of this few pages in this issue. You know, I didn't like it as much as all the Pretty Ponies, but, you know, while that one I thought had a lot of cool concepts, a lot of great stuff, it was a smaller story. This, I mean, again, we get a lot in this one.
The next one, we got Paul Cornell writing it. I didn't really get the point of this next one. You know, it's like it just, you know, this one you kind of juxtaposition of, you know, is this actually happening? Is it just like this guy's making a bunch of stuff up? Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. I just felt like I was missing something. This is a short story too. This is only 6 pages.
Yeah.
This is the one where, boy, making it the whopping length of 8 pages might have helped this one a little bit.
It would have significantly expanded the story, yes. It did almost feel like there was something missing from this. I thought it was, you know, interesting story with some good art, and if this goes to a series or miniseries, I'll probably check out the first issue. I thought, you know, what was here was, you know, was good and kind of clicked with me, but again, this is more of a standard mystery in space, you know, Strange Adventures from the Old Days sort of a story. In other words, less creepy, less, you know, supernaturally or whatever than some of these others. So just for my tastes, it worked better. But there was kind of a, okay, what exactly was the point of that story?
Yeah, I didn't even get a clear, satisfying twist ending closure at the end of this one. You know, it was just like, okay, well, yeah, that story ended. Let's go on to the next one. Now, the next one is by Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Rizzo. This one is the one of all these that is been advertised as being something that is going to be continued into a new series. Spaceman. You know, it was in the solicits and also on the cover. It says featuring the first chapter of the new series, Spaceman. So this is something that will be going on. Based on this particular chapter, and I have liked, you know, Azzarello and Rizzo in the past, I might check out the first issue, but this 8 pages did not really sell me on the series.
I mean, it's kind of, I think, ironic that this is the one that we know is going to go to a series, because for me, this worked the poorest. You know, I just didn't really care for this. Part of it was the art style didn't totally click with me. It's not bad. I mean, it's good art. But with the storytelling structure, it took them too long to get to the lead character, who we're kind of hearing from for the first couple of pages. That kind of kept me out of the story too long. You know, and I know this is going to series, but frankly, there wasn't really anything in here that made me think, yeah, I should follow it to there.
Have you ever read Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess?
No, I don't think so.
This is, how do I say, there's a lot of future slang in that book. And if I'm remembering the author's name correctly, and this is the same kind of thing. It's, you're in the future and you're sprinkling so much future slang into the story that it kind of took me out of the story as I was trying to interpret, you know, into English the distracting amount of future speak that was added in here. And I think that for some, this is, you know, it kind of adds to the experience and makes it cooler. And I think that's totally going to be experiential for the reader. You know, for me, it was, you know, some of them, you know, I'd get like right away. Other ones I'd have to sit there and think about a little bit. And I suppose I could have just blown right through it and, you know, just kind of taken a lot of these things as just nonsense words and not had tried to figure out what the heck he was, you know, going with them. But, you know what I mean on that one?
Well, yeah, I think it served to distance you from the story. Much as, you know, the time it took them to get to that lead character kind of distanced me from the story. This is something where I think part of why, like, all the Pretty Ponies and stuff worked so well for us is we get to see the lead characters immediately. We get to see the cool tech that's the twist of, you know, not the twist of the story, but the concept, kind of the stories around or whatever, immediately. Whereas here, they've got enough things kind of acting as potential barriers. The slang, you know, and stuff like that, it makes it harder to get into the story. And I think that's just a really bad move, particularly in this kind of a market. You know, I think if, instead of having already decided which of these goes to series, there was a thing at the end of, hey, go to this website and tell us which you want to go to series, maybe Spaceman would have done really well in that kind of a setup. Don't know, but I like to think all the Pretty Ponies and maybe one or two of the others would have done really well too, and that they would have at least had to have fought for that that series, you know, against some of these others a little bit more than, you know, apparently,
well,
just getting it.
You know, when you win an Eisner, like Azzarello and Rizzo did, you can kind of write your own ticket.
Hey,
you know, they say we're going to do a new series, and, you know, okay, we'll give you that series. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think that, you know, I loved 100 Bullets.
Mm-hmm.
100 Bullets was a brilliant series. This one I would have to try out an issue or two. I'm not convinced from this that I would stick around for it. But, all in all, this was like a anthology to me, in that, I really liked a story, I really disliked a story, and then the other ones kind of fell in that gray area in the middle. So I kind of end up at around a 3, which is around where a lot of anthologies end up for me.
I guess for me, because I wound up at that 3, but through a slightly different path, this came down to pretty much the sort of sci-fi stories I'd expect out of Vertigo. And for me, that was part of the problem. Vertigo tends to lean more into that horror, creepy, supernatural kind of, area than I care for. And while I found some of the ideas really interesting and cool, some of the story slants they took on them just didn't work for me. And that comes down to I'm just not a huge Vertigo reader. I'm getting Fables and Unwritten, and that's about it. Now, as we said earlier, there is an audience for this that's just going to love this. I don't fall into this category. I think if it had been a bit more straight sci-fi, such as the Helix line did way back when, I might have liked it better. Overall, again, like you said, it's an anthology.
Of it was straight sci-fi, though. I mean, out of the kind of creepy category, I would only really put the Refuse and that modern Prometheus one into that category. I just think it's more of the noir sci-fi kind of thing, as opposed to creepy. But it is definitely Vertigo-ish sci-fi, as opposed to the bright, sunny, sci-fi.
Yeah, it's
kind
a
of
darker
stuff.
Sci-fi is probably the right way to put that. That's fair. But, like you said, it's an anthology. There's always going to be some stuff you like better than others, and, some stuff that just doesn't work for you at all.
So really quick on just the DC book in general. So I'm sitting here looking at the cover of this with the banner on the top. Green Lantern, only in theaters, June 17th. Now, these comic books are sold in comic book shops exclusively, pretty much.
Yeah.
What is the point of putting a Green Lantern move? Is there anybody that sets foot in a comic shop that is not aware that a Green Lantern movie is coming out? More people see the commercial that's shown on TV like every time I turn on the television that are ever going to set into a comic shop ever.
Just to go off on that tangent just a little bit. Not only is the Green Lantern banner at the top of every comic that came out this week, but there were 3 comics that I felt should not have all come out this week. Green Lantern 66, Green Lantern Corps 60, Green Lantern Emerald Warriors 10. I would think with a Green Lantern movie coming out, you would have wanted to have a Green Lantern book pretty much every week, not 3 one week, none the next. The number of people who are going to read in total all of the DC books, at least those that hit the top 300 or whatever, in any given month, we're talking, in aggregate, maybe 2 million, 3 million tops. And that's if every comic is bought by somebody different, which we know is not the case. So the odds of this having any impact on the movie ticket sales and stuff is minimal. They should be trying to go in the other direction of get the people coming out of the movies into the comic stores. So,
and it ruins the design aesthetic of the cover completely. It's a clashing color. You take away from the cover image, you take away from the title. It's just, it's an awful, awful idea from the get-go. And I think that it's completely pointless because you're not going to drive, I don't think, a single movie ticket out of this.
Well, it certainly had no business being on a Vertigo title. The DC Universe stuff, I can kind of see.
I can see it being on the Green Lantern books, maybe. But again, it's like, why?
Part of it is by putting it on the DC books, beyond just the Green Lantern ones, but the rest of the DC Universe, it's kind of showing that, hey, our properties are so good that there are you know, a movie company is willing to invest, you know, millions and millions of dollars to turn them into movies because they think they're so great. You know, there's a certain amount of validation for the Superman property that just having had Smallville on the air for 10 years did. So, again, putting the Green Lantern banner on
so,
top.
So what you're saying to me is that I should be thanking my lucky stars that they didn't have a Smallville banner across the top of every DC book for the last 10 years. And,
no.
I'm just teasing. But
I know, but
it's just, you know.
But it's one of those things that they certainly could have put something on the Superman books the last couple of months saying, hey, the season or the series finale, 10 years of Smallville is ending, you know. That would have been, you know, a certain bragging point. So I can understand why they did it on the DC Universe stuff. I thought it was a little odd to be on the top of a Vertigo one and think it was kind of inappropriate there. But it comes down to as much a reaction probably from DC to what Marvel's doing with all of their movies on the Thor stuff, the Captain America, and all of that. So I think it's an attempt at, I don't say a PR war, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to DC. We've got
We already did DC. How about Marvel?
Let's move on to Marvel. Let's just call Marvel DC. How about that?
Yes, that's the new DC 2.0. It's all Marvel. That would be funny.
Let's move to Marvel. Secret Warriors, number 27. Wheels Within Wheels. I thought this was a good issue. I've been really liking this series. Some very shocking stuff happened in this issue. You know, especially that one page with Nick.
Yeah.
And Baron Strucker.
That's kind of where, you know, in this issue, it really reminds us why Nick Fury is Nick Fury and nobody else really is. I mean, Steve Rogers may have taken his place at the moment as kind of the head of the super spy hero type stuff, kind of publicly filling the role Nick Fury did, but this kind of showed that for some stuff, you need somebody like Nick Fury, not Captain America. You know, there's just some fundamental things that one's going to do that the other just won't. And I think this really showed that well. The one thing about this issue, though, is it does have me looking forward to the next issue, which is the end of the series. At one point, this issue was going to be the end of the series, but, you know, according to the solicit, you know, Hickman wrote so much, it was just too big to be contained in a single issue. Frankly, gut feeling is they would have been better off turning this into an oversized issue, including the contents of that next issue here, and maybe tightening this issue up a little bit. Because while that next issue may be amazing, this was just good. I mean, Hickman's a great writer, and he's doing some good stuff on this title. But frankly, there were some places this was just slow. And I think if they had tightened this up, they could have gotten it down to where they could have comfortably fit it in the next issue under the covers of one book and just completely knocked our socks off.
Well, I can see that from the standpoint that this issue had some slow moments like the last six pages. But without seeing the next page, I mean, the next issue, maybe the next issue is, you know, just a thrill a page, you know, coming out, and there's absolutely nothing that could have been chopped out of that, or who knows.
Well, and that's what I'm not saying it had to be chopped. I'm just saying if they'd tightened this one up, if we had started with the stuff with Nick Fury and ended on whatever big, you know, ending they've got on the next one, that could have been just a really, really strong package. Whereas this started strong and ended very slow. I mean, the three-page scene with the Contessa was, I mean,
yeah, that was a little stretched, too. Now, who is, am I supposed to, and I'm maybe just missed, who is Miss Johnson? Is she someone from Nick's, one of Nick's teams, or am I supposed to know who she is? And I just, my memory is not what it once was.
Yes, I think we're supposed to know who she is, and no, I don't remember either. And part of that goes down to the more leisurely pacing. Was she the one who was kind of leading the Caterpillar team or whatever we'd been following for most of the series?
Maybe.
But again, we haven't seen her for a couple
Quake.
Of months.
She's Quake.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Hickman tells good stories, but it's one of those things where the momentum, just with the standard month between issues and stuff, and the depth of the story he's telling, really, you know, the two are at odds, because it's like, okay, who is this character again? You know, are we supposed to remember? How long has it been since we've seen them? Those kinds of issues. Whereas if you read it all in one sitting, I think you'd get a much more satisfying experience. He reads fine monthly, but again, there are things like this where it's a, who is that again? So,
but, you know, even as such, I'd still give it a 4.
Yep, same here. And I'm hoping to give the next issue 5. I hope it ends really strongly. But this has
been a very strong series.
Yeah. I just get frustrated when, you know, they spend, you know, a full page of somebody walking down the street. You know, it's To have said he wrote so much it couldn't be contained in the span of an issue, and then have stuff that I felt was padded, frustrated me. But good series. I think Hickman's doing some great work over at Marvel.
And then our last one, we move over to Boom Studios, and we're hitting Incorruptible number 18. This is more of Mark Waid's take on the bad guy turned good. Counterpart to Irredeemable, which is the good guy turned bad. This issue, I liked. So we introduce a lot of new characters in this one, and a lot of them are introduced, you know, in a way that I know who they are now, and I get a little bit of an idea on their powers, but not every one of them. And, you know, I guess to some extent it's really hard to do that in the space of a story when you got, what do we got, like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, maybe 11 characters. I mean, that's a lot of new characters. Maybe even more if these two guys behind the girl with the snake around her. I don't know that I caught her name.
Yeah, I didn't catch all their names.
I'm guessing it's something like Eve, because she's got an apple in her hand and a snake around her, so I'm guessing there's some kind of Garden of Eden kind of theme going on there.
That would make sense.
I'm just going to call her Eve. But in that, you know, big, you know, kind of splash panel, there's two heads behind her, so those are probably two more. So 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13 characters just on that panel.
Yeah, but I don't know that most of these are, you know, expected to be considered, you know, major characters either in this issue or even the overall story. I mean, to me, this issue had a lot of really good kind of moving of the chess pieces stuff. We get a little bit of action with some of these characters. Again, we get these new characters, but we also get a lot of backstory on a number of other characters. And I think this is one of those issues where probably not a great jumping on point, but is kind of needed to get things from where they were to kind of set up that next phase of the series and the big picture stuff. And this just shows how much stuff Waid can kind of keep in play at one point, how he can kind of tease us with, okay, there are all these other villains, what's been happening with them? And a few we get to know, and a few are just kind of standing there. And, I mean, there's the one with the mohawk between next to the fat guy in the background. Does it matter he's even there? Probably not. It's just there's more bad guys. You know, I thought this issue ended on a strong story moment, which acted as a natural pausing point for the story and kind of a, okay, what's going to happen next? How is somebody going to react thing? I saw the introduction of all of these other villains and characters and stuff, kind of the something that needed to happen to kind of flesh some stuff out in the background. But with the exception of two or three of them, the specifics of who they are is completely irrelevant. At least it was to me.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I'm kind of like, I don't know, I'm losing interest in the Irredeemable and Incorruptible stuff last several issues. You know, it had a really strong beginning to me, and it's just started kind of meandering a little bit. Well, and that, again, it's more of a personal perception of how I'm, you know, what I'm getting out of the stories.
No, but you know? But I get it, because I think these, particularly with Irredeemable and stuff, is a hard premise to keep ongoing for the long term. The basic idea is you've got a Superman-type character who completely flips out and goes on a destructive rampage and basically goes nuts. that's really good at the beginning, but then, okay, we're about 2 years into this whole story arc or story world or whatever, because this title is started about 6 months later or whatever, and, you know, the Plutonian's off-planet, he's no longer an issue, so it's kind of a what happens next, and Wade's doing a great job with this, but it's not one of those premises where it's like, yeah, I can see this running for 20, 30, 40 years, no problem, like, you know, a number of other more standard superhero premises.
And I guess on, you know, as far as that goes, he reinvigorated my interest over on Irredeemable a little bit by, you know, taking him off planet and introducing some new situations and stuff. On this one, you take the Plutonian out of this book, and sure, there's this kind of rebuilding society after the Plutonian, you know, kind of did a number on the world kind of thing. And maybe this Hayes Bellamy guy in the background is going to provide enough of a conflict point there. Maybe that's what this, you know, whole thing of all these bad guys who used to be on the same side as Max Damage and now, you know, he's going to be going against them. I mean, it's setting up a new set of points of conflict for him. You know, they have to fill the void left by the Plutonian who went off world.
I mean, to me, this was very much a transition phase that, okay, now that the big threat's gone, they've got to figure out, okay, how do we rebuild whatever? It looks like, like you said, this Hayes Bellamy's kind of coming in to take advantage of that opportunity, and it's going to be, I think, maybe another few issues before this really gets to, oh crap, that's what's going on, and kind of kicks back into really high gear. But I think for a lot of titles of this nature, where again, it's not a foregone conclusion of this is how things are going to play out or what have you, you're going to have these kind of transition phases in the title. And I think it's understandable why somebody's interest might wane a little. I mean, for me, this was a kind of a high 3, low 4 right there on that border, and I'm kind of torn as to which way to knock it, you know? I'm probably going to go with the 3, because this seemed like more, like I said, of a transition issue, not one of those where it's like, oh, wow, you've just got to be reading this issue. So,
yeah, this one for me definitely fell into the 3 category. I think another thing that is maybe not working as well for me as it could have is at some point the artist changed on this series. I guess it's probably changed more than once on this series. And this latest guy, Marcio Takara, who has been he's been around for several issues. It's perfectly fine art, but it's just not, I mean, it tells the story. It's just not my favorite kind of art style. I think maybe he's been around since maybe after the first year. I don't remember exactly what issue. I mean, he's been around for a while, so it's not like he just came in on this issue or something, but just not my favorite art ever.
I can see that. It's serviceable art, but
helps.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't help, rather.
Yeah. It's not an art style that's, oh my god, I've got to be getting it just for the art or whatever.
Yeah, and maybe for someone it is, but it's not for me. You know, it's there. It's not a plus for the book. I mean, if Wade was working with someone who was someone who I'm a particular fan of, you know, that, you know, I look at the art and I'm like, wow, that art just blows me away, that would really be notching each one of these issues up. But as it stands, this is being carried in the large part by Wade's writing. So when it kind of falters a little bit in, you know, transitional issues, then it kind of pulls my enjoyment of the whole series down.
I can see that. And, you know, in fairness, I think there are a lot of titles out there where the writer is definitely the focal point of interest. And, you know, kind of the best thing some of these artists can do is just kind of stay out of the way. serve the story but not try to get too flashy or something like that, and, you know, just don't get in the way of and don't detract from the story. And in that respect, I think this guy does a good job there.
Yeah. You know. Quick search, and he's been on this since issue 11. So, you know, 8 issues in. Okay, so that was the week that was in comics. I am looking forward to next week's shipment as we get some more of the Flashpoint miniseries, which, you know, kind of briefly, you know, I will say on the Flashpoint topic that, you know, I only pre-ordered like 6 of the 16 Flashpoint minis.
Mm-hmm.
There's 16 of them, right?
16 miniseries that I think are 3 issues each, and then 4 one-shots the first month.
And, you know, I went on record, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, as saying I don't have anything against the other ones. It's just given I don't recognize the creative teams and there's only a 5-word solicit, I'm not going to pre-order 3 issues of all these series before I see them, so I will pick them up and look at them on the rack.
Now, in fairness, their haiku master over at DC Marketing got up to 11 words in one case.
Okay.
But I do agree that the abbreviated nature of those solicits was a unbelievable poor decision.
That was nuts. Given that, you know, 4 of the minis, or 5, hit the stores this week. We won't see them until next Tuesday, but the ones that I did not order, there were 2 of them. That was the World of Flashpoint and Abin Sur Green Lantern. I did pick up in the shop. I did flip through them. They looked good, read a couple of pages. They read good, took them home, read them, and I enjoyed them quite a lot, which actually makes me very, and I have subsequently added issues 2 and 3 of those to my ongoing pull, so I'll get the rest of those series, which makes me very confident, because even though I wasn't that big on Flashpoint number 1, I really liked Booster Gold number 44, and now the first 2 of these mini-series that are really, the creative teams are not people I'm familiar with at all, I thought were really well done. Which makes me seem very confident now that, you know, DC is holding some really strong standards for this event.
Well, I hope so. And like I said, I you know, we'll be getting all of those next week because I did pre-order all of them. So,
and I'm maybe now kind of figuring, okay, as the next ones come out, you know, I don't know, are they going to convert me to a clean sweep on Flashpoint? Who knows?
To me, these are the types of titles, even if they're only so-so or whatever, if you're going to get them, it makes sense to get them as they come out, because their relevance is in the moment. You know, it's going to make sense in the context of Flashpoint. If you read just some of these one-shots or miniseries by themselves 2-3 years from now, outside of the context of Flashpoint, you're going to be like, okay, so what was going on back in Flashpoint? Where were these characters at? What was going on? It's going to make less sense. But, I mean, that's just my personal opinion on that.
I think any event is like that. You know, I picked up a lot of the Chaos Wars stuff after the fact, and going back and looking at it after the fact, I'm kind of like, I really don't care. You know, it's like, okay, I bought these for a buck, but it's like, this is really pointless.
The thing there is the story's over, you know how the big picture ended. The difference, I think, with Flashpoint that's going to magnify that effect is the characters are fundamentally different because it's an altered timeline.
Yeah.
So are you going to remember what was, you know, up with the Shazam team or what have you, or all that stuff? So I'm looking forward to those. I'll read them and stuff when they come out and I get them in my next shipment. So anything else on the comics from this week?
That's it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Superboy number 8 from DC, S.H.I.E.L.D. Volume 2 number 1 from Marvel, and Foster Broussard, Demons of the Gold Rush number 1 from Red 5 Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.